What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and apologies, first off, to all you listeners for no Friday Pod last week. I was just buried with a couple of big projects, but we are back, and just in time, not just for opening night of the NBA season, which is coming up, but just in time for the NBA's much-anticipated, much-hyped, sure-to-be-intriguing as all get-out 75th anniversary team. This is the NBA's 75th year, of course, and so the league convened a blue ribbon panel to select the 75 greatest players in NBA history. It will be rolled out in three segments. Starting Tuesday night, opening night, we'll get the first group of 25 during TNT's broadcast, starting at 6 Eastern time. On Wednesday, it's ESPN's turn, and my good friend Malika Andrews launching her new show. Congrats, Malika. That will be at 3 p.m. Eastern time. And then the final 25 players will come out Thursday back on TNT at 6 Eastern time. My guest today, and here to discuss all of this, is a member of the 50th anniversary team, and I'm pretty confident he'll be on the 75th too. He is Clyde Drexler, and he's serving as an ambassador for the league for the 75th anniversary season. I don't know what it means to be an ambassador for the NBA. Do you get special privileges in other countries? Can you issue new passports to U.S. travelers if they've lost that? I don't know. We'll ask. And we'll discuss this whole list, this process, and much more about the coming season. Before we get to that, a reminder, please subscribe, rate, review the Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube. Search Sports Illustrated Podcasts. That channel has the Crossover Pod, the Open Floor Pod, all the other great SI podcasts. And of course, hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, lots to discuss with the great Clyde Drexler coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by the Hall of Famer, Clyde Drexler. Clyde, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be with you, Howard.
Appreciate you. So, in addition to other things that we'll discuss, congrats on your ambassadorship with the NBA 75th. I need to clarify this. What is an NBA ambassador? Do you get like special privileges overseas? Do you attend state dinners? If I lose my passport in Amsterdam, can you help me? What's the ambassador privileges?
Well, Howard, that's a great question. As one of five ambassadors of the NBA 75th anniversary, it's a tremendous honor. And all five ambassadors really represent different eras of the NBA, right? And so it's an honor to be selected one of them. I don't know if I have any immunity privileges, but I'm working on it.
It's, you know, like in all the movies, right? If you have the ambassador license plates, like the law enforcement can't touch you. You can park wherever you want. They can't give you parking. Like, that would be great if that's what this comes with.
Oh, I would love to have one of those license plates where you can just park anywhere. Nobody bothers you. Hey, we're working on that. That's a great idea.
Thank you. This is what I'm here for. I'll see if I can get the NBA to work on that application. So the other ambassadors, of course, for the 75th anniversary, Magic Johnson, Bob Pettit, Oscar Robertson, and Dirk Nowitzki, each of you representing certain eras of the NBA. You and I were both voters for this, but because we're recording this before it's revealed, of course, we will not talk in detail about our ballots. But I had this discussion and deliberation with Jack McCallum, a fellow voter a few weeks back, and this was really tough, Clyde. And I don't know if it's harder or easier for you as a voter who is a former player, who these are your peers and your rivals, your predecessors, your success. Like, you have a different view into this. Do you think it made it easier or harder to do this exercise?
It's so hard because so many guys are deserving. And to narrow that list to 75 is tremendously hard, especially when you know how good guys were in your era. Who may be left off of that list, it's extremely hard because they're deserving. But when you have so many qualified applicants, you just got to go through the process and make a selection based upon who was the most productive during their time, who meant the most to their teams, who was the best leader. And so those were the things I gave high consideration to.
So you just threw out a bunch of possible ways to define this, right? And one of the things that I struggled with, and I'll throw this to you, is this list of 75, is it supposed to be literally the greatest 75 to ever play in the NBA? Or is this just, because it's a 75th anniversary team, more about let's make sure it's representative of all the eras? Because let's face it, if you start pitting players from 2021 against players from 1963, it's a different game. Athletes have evolved. So is it the greatest 75, or is it the 75 that best represent the whole of NBA history?
In my opinion, it's the greatest 75, because you know what? You have to go by who dominated in their era. That's all you can go by. And so even though it's a different game, no two-handed jump shots today, but for the most part, the guys who dominated back then would still dominate in today's game. And
you
so you look at who was dominant. Who demanded the double teams? Who was the leader of their team and propelled their teammates, made everybody better? Who's consistently good night in and night out? Those are the things you look at. It wasn't just about championships. It was about who was a leader, who's a winner, what kind of players did you play with, and how did you perform with them? And so a guy who commanded the double team and team's game plan to stop him night in and night out, I gave that guy more credibility than a guy who was just a spot shooter in case, you know, his man left him. You know, he didn't really do much. He could shoot, but he's not the engine. You know what I'm saying? And so I gave those types of things a little bit more consideration.
Yeah. I think I ask it because the game, basketball and the NBA in particular, I think evolves more than any other sport, right? The rules change, the strategy changes, and obviously just the athletes have changed. Today's athletes are bigger and stronger and quicker and more explosive. I would say they're more skilled overall. They're better trained. They are year-round at this. It's not some part-time thing. They're not having a beer at halftime. They're not smoking.
Or a cigarette.
Hello. Shout out to Vlade Divac. I think it's hard to compare because I think you could have a guy who might be the, I don't know, I don't want to insult anybody, but like the 10th best guard today might be better than the best guard in 1959 or something. Like, I'm just throwing that out.
Or vice versa.
So I just think that made it difficult. And so I took the top 50. You were, of course, a member of the top 50. By the way, do you have rules on this? Could you vote for yourself for the top 75?
You couldn't vote for yourself. That was one of the rules, which is great.
Good. So that's some pressure off right there. You didn't have to like evaluate you versus Reggie Miller or something.
Never would do that.
You're way better than Reggie Miller anyway. That's not even an
argument.
No, I
love Reggie. And, you know, guys who played in my era like Reggie were phenomenal players. Joe Dumars, another one. Rolando Blackman. Think about that. All those guys are phenomenal. Michael Jordan. I mean, you had some of the best two guards. Mitch Richmond. I mean, just think about all these guys who could light you up. And there were guys like Ricky Pierce, Dale Ellis, who not even mentioned Lafayette Leiber. Those guys would embarrass you on a nightly basis.
Well, shooting guard was like, that was a glamour spot back then, and it faded for a while, right? And we've got all these hybrid guards who are scorers at the point guard position now, and so shooting guard, like, there's not, like, it's made a little bit of a comeback, I feel like, but there was a point maybe 7-8 years ago, and I think I wrote about it felt like the shooting guard had completely faded as the glamour spot, right? Kobe was in his twilight at that point, I think, of his career, and Bradley Beal was still, I think, coming up. And then you got even guys like James Harden, who ended up going from being one of the best shooting guards to being, no, now he's one of the best point guards in the league. Like, they're just, it's weird the way your position has evolved.
But, you know, a lot of the great shooting guards that you mentioned, they can not only score, but they also created for the teammates. So as a point guard, so to say, I was that way. You know, I didn't play point. I did, actually. But a few years, I was just a two. I didn't want to bring it down or guard the smallest guys as I got older. So I played specifically two. But for the most part, when it came down to running the offense, I was the creator. I was the guy that made it happen. And so even though you're the two, you're playing the one when it counts. Kind of like LeBron. He's a point forward. I was, the point two guard, you know.
Sure.
And there were a lot of guys who did that. Michael Jordan did that.
Sure.
There are a lot of guys who did that. And did it well. Kobe did it. Dwayne Wade did it.
Yeah, I've always made the case, and I'll, you know, it's fine. People want to disagree with this one, but like, I think if we talk about the best point guards of all time, I feel like LeBron should actually be in that discussion. If like he's actually been the point of every team he's ever played for. Like we've called him a forward and a point forward and this and that. Like, dude has run every offense of every team, almost every minute of every game of his career. I don't understand exactly how we decide that he is generally defined as a forward, but you know, Magic, who was another big guard and of course ran the offense, it doesn't make sense to me. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, here's how you categorize it, Howard. You put them good players on the floor. Don't try to give them a position. Just give them the ball and get out their way. And so that's basically what it is.
There you go.
You know, the talent knows that, but it's the fans who have trouble categorizing it. And I always say, just put good players on the floor. They will figure it out.
Without revealing anything about your top 75 ballot, because we don't want to tip our hands, who did you think was the biggest snub from the top 50 list in 96?
I thought it was Dominique Wilkins by and large. He's the seventh leading scorer all time at the time. And you know how hard it is to score those kind of points, especially a guy like Dominique, who's getting a double team night in and night out, the toughest defender. Teams are game planning to stop him, and he still gives you 35, 40 points like it's nothing. I mean, that's my definition of a legend. And had he played with better players, he would have been in more finals and maybe had a chance to win more rings. But because this is basketball is a team sport, it's not tennis or golf. You know, you can't if you put him on some. Think about it. If he plays with McHale and Parrish and DJ and Ainge, how do you think he would do as a small forward? He'd have just as many rings as Bird, I believe. Or if you put him playing with Magic and Kareem and Byron Scott and Rambis, how would he do? Just switch him Word and Bird out. Dominique would be equally as fantastic, if not better. And so. That's the way I look at it. Did he command a double team? Yes. Did we game plan to stop him every night and still couldn't? Yes. So that was the obvious snub in 97.
It was. And it's funny how many people, like, it seems like there's almost universal agreement about that, except apparently among the people who voted for the team that left him off. So what do you think? Do you think it was simply the lack of postseason success that held him back then? Because everybody agrees now that he should have been on.
He should have been on then. That's a no-brainer. But I think a lot of times when you put up numbers on a bad team, people just view you as a bloody gunner. But had he had better players, he would do the same thing, and he would fit in because he's a winner. I mean, you have to be there. You have to know. But if you look at his stats, he was always competitive. Back then when he played Philly and Boston with the toast of the East. But Atlanta was always the team that was threatening, Milwaukee and Atlanta. And so give him credit for being a winner, and he elevated his team. He just didn't have enough talent around him. Like back then, we couldn't say, hey, I'm just going to go play with the Lakers because I think I can get a ring. You know, we did, that wasn't heard of back then. The general managers made those decisions.
Well, so while we're still discussing the 50 versus the 75, so one way of doing this was take the 50 as gospel, keep it, and then just add 25 more from the 25 years since then. Although it's not even 25 years. It's more like 30-something because there are guys who had only been in the league a couple of years. Shaq was the only one who got in with only like 4 years experience. That was controversial at the time. But so you've got this whole span of decades of all these players. So one way is keep the 50, and now you've got way too many guys to jam down to that final 25. Or you reopen it and you say, you know what? Top 50 is not sacrosanct. You can knock some guys off. Did you go into it open-minded like that? I'm going to construct 75 from scratch, or did you look at the 50 as like those are already a given, including of course Clyde Drexler, who you could not vote for? How'd you handle it?
Well, Howard, I did the latter. I scratched it. I started from nothing. And you want the 75 best players, regardless of what era they played in. Whoever was dominant in the era, I gave them credit. And, you know, anybody who was dominant in the era would be dominant in today's game, maybe even better because the rules are so relaxed. Think about it. There's no hand checking. Those guys did this with two hands on them, two hand checking, or one hand checking and an elbow. So these guys are really tough, real players. And so, you know, the asterisk would be today would because the players today are playing with no hand checking. So the defense is not as good, right? And so those are the things that we think about as purists of the game from an integrity standpoint. And so I gave the guys who played in the 50s and 60s their credit because they were dominant during that time.
Yeah. So you still ended up with your 75 still fairly representative of each individual era. Even though you're starting from scratch, you feel like yours still kind of represents, you know, dominant in your time, not necessarily trying to compare across the eras, but dominant in your time, and you've got the full span.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because you put up those numbers. Obviously, you were one of the greats, the best of your time at that time. And so you can't take that away from guys. You know, I hate to see guys get better as the time goes by. No, you are who you are. If you didn't command a double team when you played, you shouldn't command a double team after you retire. Think about that.
So people always play this game, right? We talk about the rules changes, like, oh my gosh, how much would Michael Jordan have averaged today with no handshaking in the game, whatever? How much would Clyde Drexler have averaged if there were no handshaking?
Again, Michael and I both would, at least as much as we want. It just depends on what we needed. But you can at least add 10, at least add 10 points.
Well, the other thing, too, is what's interesting is, you know, we now have the stat usage rate. Usage rate was not something we ever talked about in the 70s, 80s, 90s, even early 2000s until the advanced stats come along. So we can now measure, like, that James Harden, Russell Westbrook, and certain Luka, Giannis, they have these massive usage rates. And even Michael, as great as he was, or as great a scorer as you were, you did not have the ball in your hands nearly as much as the way stars are now just maximized now. So that would have an influence too. That would be an interesting kind of, you know, another one of these hypotheticals that we can never prove, but what you would have done if you got the ball like Harden did and just said, Clyde, just go out there and create every time. If you can score, score. If it gets somebody else open, then do it. But you've got maximum control.
Yeah. You know, Howard, you bring up, for a young guy, you bring up the best point. It's all about usage. You know, back when we played, you had to share the ball. Why? Because you had other guys who had to play and put up numbers to get their contracts. You know, if they played with me and I averaged 30 and we did okay, but they averaged 5, when they went in to get their contract, the general manager is going to say, what did you do? I know what they did. What did you do? And so you had to share the ball. These guys wanted their touches. They were better defenders if they got them. They were better teammates if they got them. And we're going to win more if they got their touches. And so as part of my job was to make sure everyone got their touches. Now, if the game got close in the fourth quarter, then you could take over. But the first three quarters, it was basically managing the game. It wasn't trying to put up numbers or lead the league in scoring. As a matter of fact, I would tell you most of my points were scored in the second half because the first half, I'm just orchestrating the game. That doesn't mean you could not have. We could have put up big numbers. But if you're trying to win, that's what it took. We were a better team. One individual score is not going to beat anybody. And so you got to do what's right for the team. But these guys today, with the massive usage, I give them a lot of credit because, one, it's not easy. It takes a lot of stamina to do that, night in and night out, right? And so I give them a lot of credit, but you have so many more opportunities to create for yourself and your teammates. And so you're more involved in the game. Like when I play, just take the Portland Trailblazers team. If Jerome Kersey doesn't have his points, he's got his head down a little bit. And you know, it's my job to make sure that he feels good about his game. That's every night. So I got to figure out a way to create for him, whether it's in transition or in a half-court set, to get him some easy buckets. I mean, so that was a lot of my focus. And it wasn't just him. It was all of my teammates. If they were having a tough night, you got to create for them. And so the guys today, they don't – it's almost like – I'll pass it if the double team is so good I got to get rid of it. No, I'll pass it. But they're not really looking to create for their teammates the way we had to back in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, it's kind of like last resort, right? It's I'm going to do everything possible. I'm going to make 7 different moves. Wait, nope, I'm still bottled up. All right, I'm going to hit my shooter now.
It's like, yeah, it's almost like if the coach calls you a play, you got to ISO play, right? Was I'm shooting this thing. But no, I mean, every play we had ISO, but I'm looking to get other people the ball. Now, had I had a more, you know, let me put up some numbers attitude, I don't know if we would have been as successful. And I don't know if I would have been as durable because it takes a lot of effort to do that night in and night out. Key was for us, it's a marathon. And you want to be healthy in May and June. And so you do what you have to do in the regular season, but you make sure you're healthy when it counts.
and we don't need to go down this rabbit hole, but I'll just add real quick, because I've written about this a couple times in the last couple of years. But I mean, the guys who are incredibly ball dominant with these astronomical usage rates now, generally speaking, have short circuited at some point. And I got to think, and it's impossible to prove, Daryl Morey and I have debated this 17 times, but that if you don't keep your teammates involved and happy the way you were just describing, Clyde, as like, it's my job as the star to keep my guys feeling good about themselves and in rhythm, I think that a price is paid. I don't know if it's provable. This may just be, you know, squishy sports psychology stuff. That's certainly how it seemed. Daryl viewed it when we discussed or debated this. But I think I think it matters. I think it matters how your teammates feel and whether they feel involved and motivated and engaged. So I don't
100%.
Know.
You're a much better team when everyone feels like they have adequate input and participation. I mean, nobody wants to just watch one guy go to work and you're sitting over there weak and wide, you know, just watching the action every night. That is a boring game for everybody. You want to feel like you have a teammate. He's good, but if I'm open, I know he's going to get me the ball. And that's what makes you a true superstar and a leader.
All right. So you mentioned a couple minutes ago, Clyde, that back in your day, the GMs pretty much put their own teams together. It was not the superstar empowerment era, as we call it, of the last 10 years. Generally true. Guys are now teaming up. They're using free agency to make power plays and everything else. However, you did force a trade, a fairly historic and important one, from Portland to Houston back in your day. So how would you look at that or frame that in the context of today's discussion about stars creating their own teams? Because you got to go play with Akeem and then Barkley in Houston by forcing your way out of Portland.
Well, Barkley didn't come till later. But here's the deal. I stayed there 11 and a half seasons on their team. But I had some input, and that's why we were somewhat successful, because you need to tell them what you need as a player, what we need to be more successful. And then kind of listen. And then they management changed and they started to go the other way. They were starting to devalue the team. We had a championship team. And they were starting to thinking about rebuilding. And I'm like, I don't really want to go through a rebuilding. I like to still fight for a championship. I still think, you know, that's the ultimate measure of the game. And so I kind of forced that trade because I've given them a lot of time to get it together. Now, if they start going the other way, it's up to you to make a decision. Now, if I did make that decision, I don't think I'd get a championship. Mm-hmm. And so it was a great decision. Luckily, all parties involved made it happen, and it was a blessing. But, you give them a certain time period, and if they don't improve, like Antetokounmpo, I mean, what if he had left the year before when they got knocked off by the Heat? Mm-hmm. What if he said, that's it. I'm not giving you guys any more time to get any more players to play with me. I'm leaving. But he had patience. I had 11 and a half years. That's a lot of patience.
That's a lot.
Think about it. So give the team, that drafted you, a little loyalty, a little patience, but don't let them ruin your entire career is what I would say.
Yeah, good advice. Did you get to – how much input did you have on your destination back then?
A lot of input. Houston is where I'm from. That's the only place I would have gone. Because, one, they were good. They had won the championship in 94. They had a little discord on their team. I knew they really wanted me, and so that played a part in it. When you want it, and they know you can make a difference. And luckily, things worked out. We went back. We won a championship right away. 2 years later, we got Barkley.
And that was a whole other era.
So we all had to retire. We're too old by that time.
If you could have, if you had the latitude back then that guys have now, and part of this is just shorter contracts, part of it's the contracts are so just stupidly, ridiculously rich that you can afford to take some chances and maybe even sacrifice a year of guaranteed money. Like, guys just have a lot of freedom on various levels. If you could have back then said, you know what, in the summer of 93, I'm forming my own team. I'm in free agency. Some other guys are. And you could do what like LeBron and Bosch and Wade did back in the day. Like, who would you have formed your hypothetical super team with?
That's a great question. I mean, there are so many great players back in the day. But I think, you have to have some integrity. You can't be a front runner. But just think about all the great players of that time. I mean, it would have been easy to get together and say, hey, guys, let's go put the team together and try to win. But that's not the way the game should be played. I mean, these franchises invest a lot of money into selecting the personnel. And if they select you, they have full faith and confidence in you. If they select you in the first round, you should give them everything you have. I truly believe that. Now, but don't let them ruin your entire career if they don't put good pieces around you. It's their job to try to put good pieces around you. And everyone knows it's easy to see. You know if you're going to have a chance to win or not. I remember one year I'm in Portland, and this is just one instance, and I'm sure they had good intentions, but we're playing against the Lakers in the first round of the playoffs. I think it's 1986 or 7, one or the other. Can't remember that far back, Howard. But they had five number one picks on their team, Kareem, Magic, Worthy, Michael Thompson, and probably McAdoo. Then you had guys like Michael Cooper, Byron Scott, A.C. Green on that team, all these great players, right? I got three guys with 10-day contracts on my team. I got Caldwell Jones. I got old Maurice Lucas. I was like, how is this supposed to happen? So, you know, there were instances like that. And that's when you go, hey, guys, you got to get some talent in here, you know?
Yeah.
And so those things happen, though. But that's why talent and management is everything. When you got good management, those players will stay. If you got incompetent management year after year, you may make some mistakes, but year after year after year, you got to make some good decisions.
A few more before I let you go. I was curious how you feel about how the Nets handled the Kyrie Irving thing. We don't need to get into vaccine discussions and all that stuff, but I just mean as a basketball matter, they had a choice, right? We have 39 games of Kyrie because he can't play the home games or the games at the Garden, or no Kyrie. And I wonder just... because we all talk about Clyde in the media. We talk about this all the time about chemistry and camaraderie and all these things. And they sound like buzzwords. We all get numb to it after a while, culture and all this stuff. But I do wonder, like a guy who's that intrinsic to your team's success, who's that valuable, that talented, can a team function with a part-time player? If you know, well, you know what? Well, we just have these 39 games. It'll be the road games. He can practice with us. Like, was that a viable way of going, or do you think they made the right decision from just, like I say, not a public health standpoint, purely a basketball standpoint of not being able to adjust constantly of having him coming and going? How do you view that?
Howard, you know, I respect everyone's right to choice. That's the first thing. I love Kyrie as a player, and I think he thinks he's doing the right thing. So I think the Nets think they have to do what they have to do. And is it going to be a labor issue? Obviously, big time. This is a pandemic. And so things are different. You have to make adjustments on the fly. It's not your natural way of doing things. And so sometimes they don't blend. And this is one of those times. I feel for Kyrie because he feels like he's standing up for the right thing. And the Nets, obviously, it's about business, it's basketball. And so I wish they can work that out in some amicable way, because Kyrie is a phenomenal player and everyone wants to see him perform. And so hopefully going forward, there'll be ways that they can work together and collaborate and make it happen.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it must be though on some basketball level though, just as a chemistry matter of like, you know, not having the consistency over the course of a season. That seems like a real issue to me. Like again, as a purely a basketball matter, not about anything else. That does seem like that would be difficult to navigate. Now, if it's, you know, you're third shooter off the bench, you're, you know, backup to the backup point guard or something, it's one thing. But if it's a guy who's going to have the ball in his hands a lot, everything else, you're basically two teams if you have him for only half the games, right?
Yeah, you know, you're right. But here's where they have an advantage. You got two other guys that are increased their usage because he's not there. Sure. And that's a plus because they wanted better players in the league. And that's James Harden and Kevin Durant. They'll get more usage they've proven that they're pretty good when they get a lot of usage. The problem, but if Kyrie comes back, then they know, you know what, we got to share the rock. And so those guys are experienced, they're knowledgeable. So they have a leg up in that department. It won't be a big chemistry issue, as you mentioned earlier, like with other teams who don't have guys who are so accomplished.
Yeah.
But the Nets can survive it. I think they will, and hopefully they'll find an amicable solution where all parties can be represented properly.
All right. So the other awkward situation, so I can put you on the spot one more time here. If you are a teammate of Ben Simmons and he has been holding out, basically saying, I'm never playing there again, I want to be traded. And then it's, okay, I guess maybe I better show up and protect my paycheck. How awkward of a locker room is that right now, you think?
Well, I think Daryl Morey has got a real problem there. And, what's my guy from Duke?
What's Elton? His name? Elton Brand?
Elton. Yeah, they got good problems. And Doc Rivers, they got good problems. But for the most part, I think they're all mature. They play together. It's not going to be a bigger issue as you think, because once they hit the floor, it's all about performance. They're not going to be thinking, well, this guy wants to leave. No, all they're going to see is he's here, he's present, and we're playing to win. And so players have a better understanding, and fans always like to think of chemistry. But players are friends. They get along or not, but they know it's their job to go out and perform. And so that's the bigger issue. And I think Simmons, I think he has a lot to prove. I think if I'm Ben Simmons, who's a very talented young man, I think he's got to prove, you know what, I'm not afraid to score points. Let me come out here and just light people up and let you know that I'm a basketball player who plays both ends of the court, not just one end. You got to score points if you're an NBA player. You can't not look at the basket. Those are fundamental things. And so if I'm Ben Simmons and he can do it, my only thought is I'm going to let people know I'm going to put points on the board. Watch this. And if he does that, I think things will take care of themselves.
Which is funny too, Clyde, because you think about it, like in the history of the game, or at least my entire lifetime, that's how we see stars, especially stars who are ball handlers. That's how they're built. Like if anything, we're usually chiding them for the opposite, which is, dude, do a little less. Like, you're shooting too much. Like, back off a little bit. Get your teammates involved, as we were discussing earlier.
Exactly.
But he is the complete inverse. It's really, is there any in your time as a player, as a veteran, as, you know, as a fan back before you were in the league, do you ever remember anybody with the talent of a Ben Simmons who was that reluctant of a shooter or scorer? I don't know there's any precedent for him.
There were guys who you could see had tons of talent, but they are, as you called them, reluctant shooters. There were guys like Rodney McCray. He had crazy talent, but he wouldn't put up many shots. You go, what's going on, Rodney? You know, you probably could score a whole lot more. Your team would be better, but he was so unselfish, he didn't see it, you know. But there were guys like that who were multi-talented, and you wonder, why don't they put up like hot John Williams, a hot plate, as they called it. He was another guy. He could put up a lot of numbers, but he never did. It's like, why? And so you have to think that part of that is inside their head, and the other half is probably just wanting to be a good teammate. And so all of that is just something, you know, that's when you need a leader on the team to say, hey, we need you to shoot a little bit more. We need you to score 17 to 20 points tonight. Can you do that for me? You know, so you got to have those roles defined. And if you do, now if they don't do it, that means they're not capable. But you got to define those roles a little bit more.
Are you still doing some Rockets broadcast this season?
No, I'm 2 years retired from the Rockets.
Years retired. I was trying to find. I couldn't remember if you had actually like phased out or not. So, all right. So, but you are in Houston. You're a Houston guy. The Rockets are in this rebuild. Jalen Green, Kevin Porter Jr., Sengun, Jay Sean. Like, it's a really young team. John Wall is under contract but not playing and maybe traded. So I don't know what's going on with John Wall.
I want John Wall's job. Pay me $41 million and say, you know what? Don't even think about coming to work. Don't even worry about it.
It's a good deal if you can get it. I've been looking for that my entire life. We don't get those in journalism, sadly. So where do you think your Rockets, I'm going to call them your Rockets, where are they right now? What do you see from this team, from that young talent? I don't know how much you've watched in the preseason. Where's this team heading?
Well, Howard, I want to get you straight here. I love the Rockets, but I also love the Trailblazers. Okay, those are my two teams. So that will never change. But the Rockets, just, you know, they got some great young talent. I think they're going to have a few years of getting to know each other. Can you remember those Lakers teams after Kobe when they had all that young talent and they still didn't have a lot of success? And so what happened? They put them all together and they picked up LeBron. And so just because you have young talent, there's no guarantee that that's going to bring good results. And so what you need to do is mix that young talent with some proven veterans and then try to win, because your season ticket holders are only going to have so much patience.
No doubt. But there's some exciting young talent there. I mean, Jalen Green and Kevin Porter Jr. alone, I mean, that's probably worth the price of admission. May not win a lot of games because youth doesn't yet generally win in this league, as we both know. But certainly some incredible talent, and I think we'll put on some highlights over the course of many losses.
Yeah, but, you know, the West is loaded. They got a lot of great teams. You think about Phoenix, the Nuggets, the Mavericks. You got the Lakers, Clippers. You got the Jazz. You got the Blazers. You got eight, ten teams that are loaded. Don't forget about the Spurs. never count Popovich out, but there are so never. Memphis. There are so many good teams in the West. And so when you look at, I always say, when you look around and you're looking for what I call the yummy bears, Howard, the teams that you know you can beat, right? So the teams that are less talented, in your opinion, and you don't see many of them. You know what that means? You are it. That's what it is.
No, and that's the funny thing about the West, Clive. We'll get you out in a second here, but like we all kind of default to the Lakers based on the talent at the very top there, their big three, although there's a lot of adjustments that are going to have to happen there, and they've turned over the entire roster around LeBron and AD. But if there's any slip there, like that next group, like if it's not the Lakers, then it's who? Like, that's a really hard question to answer, because Denver, Utah, Phoenix, maybe even the Clippers, we don't know when Kawhi is coming back or when Jamal Murray is coming back. There's so much parity in that next group of like, say, four or five, and then there's another group below them that's kind of competitive. Like, it really is tough. And I should just ask you this to get you out of here. Is it Lakers Nets in the finals? Do you think it's actually going to be, a little counter to expectations here?
Howard, that's a great question, because you never know. Health is going to play a major part for the Lakers. I love the fact that they have so many veterans. Actually, it's laughable, but they're all still good and they can still play. But I love, they're the geriatric team of the NBA. I love that, right? But I think they are the favorites as well. So you got to love what they put together. They're trying to win now, and that's what it's all about. But the Nets, if they can keep everyone healthy and remedy the Kyrie situation, I think they got a lot of talent. But Philly is going to be a factor. I think Milwaukee, the defending champions, are going to be at the forefront of the conversation. And so these teams are all multi-talented. They're driven. They're playing at a very high level. And that's what's going to make for a great NBA season.
Absolutely. That season starting Tuesday night. That's when we'll also get the first 25 members of the 75th anniversary team that will be rolled out on TNT, ESPN for the second 25, and then back to TNT for the last group of 25 next Thursday. Clyde Drexler, voter, top 50 all time. I'm certain top 75 all time. I will reveal you were on my ballot, sir. So there's one piece of my ballot I'll reveal here today. Congrats on your ambassadorship and getting to park anywhere on earth you'd like to.
Howard, thank you so much. I appreciate you. I wish you continued success. And I can tell through your conversation you've had some debates with Daryl Morey, who's a great debater.
We had
many when he was in Houston. I love Daryl. Good luck to you.
We've had some knockdown, dragout ones over the phone as well. Love debating with Daryl. It's always fun. Clyde, this has been a pleasure, man. I hope we get a chance to do it again soon. Thank you so much.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Clyde Drexler. Thank you to Kat Quinn at the NBA for helping connect us. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And, of course, thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Go subscribe to the SI Podcasts channel on YouTube and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter @HowardBeck.